Every day, millions of kids go to bed without local music, but we can make a difference. Go to bgrad.io for streaming local music 24/7, or check it out on YouTube, because local music isn't something any child should be without.
You're listening to the Sound Atlas.
Check, check, check.
All right, now go.
Hey, 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 hanging out with Tommy Starr. Yeah, yeah.
Keep going.
Hey, 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 doing this thing. Check, 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 check. Check one. Check, 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 check. Hey, hey, hey.
All right, I think you're good. Blah, 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 blah. That's what I'm going to sound like. Blah, 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 blah. Tommy Starr hanging out with you on the Sound Atlas. It's Monday. It's time to yak with somebody and see what's up in the local music community. Today on the Sound Atlas, one of my favorite people. I have a lot of favorite people in the local music community. This being another one, the one and only Mr. Boone. Mr. Boone, go ahead and introduce yourself properly.
I'm Boone Froggatt from the band Otis and a good friend of Tommy Starr here.
Oh, that's so nice. I think I need that on a name tag.
There
Tommy,
you go.
Tommy Starr, good friend of Boone Froggatt at the bottom. That sounds good. So you're here today. We're going to be talking about not only Otis, because there's a lot of stuff going on with Otis, not only in the past, but these days. You guys are just busy, busy, busy. But since I know you a little bit, we're going to go back a little bit and talk about some early days and what's coming up with the band. If folks are wondering what I'm doing, I'm moving some stuff around so I can do what I need to do. But anyway, we're going to do all that kind of stuff. But first, you brought me some stuff in today, and I want to thank you. Tell everybody what you brought me today.
Not always bring, but a lot of times I'll bring Tommy something. I kind of keep an eye open while we're out on the road traveling around. If I see something that Tommy might like, yeah, I'll grab it for him. I got a Otis poster. This was back from a show we did in Macon, Georgia a couple years ago. The cool thing about it was that we got to play with James Brown's guitarist, Robert Lee Coleman, who was in the Famous Flames and the JB's. So being around him, like, it was like being around a superhero to us, you know.
Well, yeah.
And he was the part, you know, he come in with the red suit and the old funky guitars and, you know, driving this van the wheels about to fall off of. It was beautiful. But yeah, got a really, it's an interesting poster, kind of a guy sitting in a recliner in space. That makes no sense, but it turned out to be a good poster.
It is a cool poster. I appreciate that. And you brought me some CDs. You had some doubles. What'd you bring me?
I brought you a Kentucky Headhunters single that I picked up in Nashville. There are like five of them for $1. So I was like, Kentucky Headhunters, gotta have it.
Yeah.
It's the single CD of Dixie Fried.
Yeah.
So that's cool.
Another favorite. I like that song too.
Yeah, it's a good one. Then I brought you some Super Fuzz and Black Cat Bone.
Nice.
All the way from Colorado.
There we go. So you must have picked that up from Dave, that he had like a couple extra, you know, like a trunk full of them. He said, you want to take those CDs.
Oh, yeah. Dave was like, you know, a mother hen to us, man. Yeah. He was loading us down with all kinds of stuff. He tried to send us home with a kind of like a strobe light that Super Fuzz used. It's like, man, we ain't got room for that in the van.
Oh, that would have been cool, though.
But,
yeah.
Maybe next time we go visit Dave, we'll have room to bring back more stuff.
He said, go on and take those cords and go on and take that. I don't use those kind of strings anymore, and take that road case. You can have that road case. Speaking of road case, that just popped in my head. I remember for a while there was a Super Fuzz road case that was rolling around over at Dave Barrick's. And I was always like, man, why don't you let me roll that in the back of my car? And he was like, no.
Dave still got several, and I got to peruse his vintage guitar collection, which was fun.
Yeah. So now you mentioned Macon, the poster you brought me for Macon. Let me just throw this out there. Folks, those of you that may at some point be a guest here on the Sound Atlas, you do not have to bring me gifts. Boone was just nice enough to do that today. Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate that.
Well, hey, man, you brought me an Alice Cooper t-shirt last time you went and saw the Cooper.
Yeah, but you paid for that.
But hey, you had to wait in line.
That's okay. I had a connection. I didn't have to wait too long.
There you go.
But you mentioned Macon. You guys just did a this. This is going to air sometime mid September. So we'll say a couple of weeks ago, since by that time it will be. You guys played Macon.
We sure did. Macon's kind of been a special town for us musically, other than here at home in Glasgow and Bowling Green, that's Macon was the first place that we developed a following and a buzz, and things started to happen. Of course, Macon, Georgia, huge rock and roll town. Yeah. Starting, that's where Little Richard grew up. James Brown's from Augusta, just down the road. Yeah. Otis Redding, mm-hmm. and then of course the Allman Brothers Band, and it was also home to Capricorn Records. So they had bands, Marshall Tucker, Wet Willie, all that stuff happened in Macon.
Cool. We were talking about some of the cool things you brought in today. You mentioned Capricorn. One of our friends, Tammy Hensley. You know Tammy, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Tammy, one of the things that she sent me, I guess sometime last year, was a residual check sent to some of the Black Oak guys from when they were with Capricorn. Wow. It was on a canceled check from their label or whatever. It was for 79 cents.
That's great.
That was probably towards the end of that album run. But anyway, we're hanging out with Boone Froggatt here from Otis today. And we're going to be talking about, like I said, all kinds of stuff. Otis. And we're going to go back to the early, early, super early days. But right now, run down who all is in the band these days.
Myself, Boone Froggatt, John Mark Seeley on the bass, Andrew Gilpin on the drums, and of course, Steve Jewell Jr. on guitar.
Yeah, you guys have got a great lineup. All you guys are great guys, great players, and you're just getting better and better and tighter all the time. What was it? September? Was it September? When was that? That was earlier in the year when you, not September, that was last year. Earlier in the year when you guys did that show in Nashville, it was kind of like a tour kickoff at the local, remember?
Mm-hmm.
That was a heck of a set that night. And I was sitting there listening to that going, man, they got the songs just laid out just right. They got nice segues from this into that. You got nice little talk sets in between. That was a sweet set. And I think that's the one you took out on the road for a while, wasn't it?
It is. It is. It kind of the same set list we took out west with us. But it's ever-changing. We want to change something every night.
Well, that makes it interesting for you guys. And I know sometimes you have fans that'll pop up different towns. Maybe they live in Macon, but you got a show up in Virginia and they're going to make a road trip to go see you. And it's kind of cool if they're like, hey, tonight they did this other thing that they didn't do a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, that's what it's all about. Kind of a little trick we picked up from Government Mule, because I still go and check their set list and get excited because dang, Warren ain't done this since '95 or whatever. So it's very cool.
Like I said, it's for them, and I'm sure it's for you guys as well. So you guys kind of keep it interesting.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. So we're not just on autopilot.
That's right.
Doing the same thing.
Exactly. So let's go back to the super early days. Now, before we're going to get to 44 Magnum, but before 44 Magnum. Were you involved with any bands, anything like that? How did you pick up the guitar? Did you take any lessons? Stuff like that.
Well, I was very lucky to grow up in a musical family. My grandfather was an old-time bluegrass fiddler. He actually won a state championship a time or two.
Dang!
And he ran a music venue back in the 70s in Center, Kentucky, and actually Itchy Brother played there, Steve and Terry Warner from, of course, country music, and then, Sam Bush and John Cowan, they played there some as well. So
nice.
Then my dad is a great guitar player, and then they still had this band going, when I was a kid. So this is what I grew up doing. If it was a Christmas or a birthday, there's always guitars around, mandolins, there was always music.
Music's always been in the house. Stringed instruments of some kind have always been laying around.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Did you take lessons or you just kind of picked it up from the family?
Kind of picked it up from the family. I've never really taken a formal lesson, you would say, but it was really good to learn how to get lessons just by watching and listening. I think listening to music is 10 times more important than playing music.
Yeah.
The more you listen, the more you have to draw from.
Sure, that makes sense. Now, how about some early influences as far as music, some stuff you were listening to, those formative years, as they call them?
Well, I really hadn't been introduced to a lot of rock and roll yet, so I was listening to stuff my parents had, especially my dad. He had, Jerry Lee Lewis, Elvis.
I love The Killer.
Oh, yeah, The Killer's great. Merle Haggard, all the great country stuff. Bill Monroe, I heard all the bluegrass stuff. And then, of course, he was a huge fan of Fabulous Thunderbirds, Georgia Satellites.
Yeah.
And then there was always headhunters, you know, mm-hmm. especially growing up in the area. You know, you'd see them around town. They yeah. played them on the radio to death. They're on TV. You know, there was always headhunters.
Yeah. That's cool. Now, a few minutes ago, you mentioned Itchy Brother just because this popped in my head. Do you still own the Itchy Brother guitar?
I do. Actually, that was a Thoroughbred guitar.
Thoroughbred guitar.
I'm not sure if it was ever used in Itchy Brother, but okay. for sure I know it was in Thoroughbred.
Yeah, now Thoroughbred, those that don't know, we'll let you educate them.
That was a band that was between Itchy Brother and the Headhunters.
Yeah, and I think that they've tried really, really hard to make sure none of those photos get out.
Yeah, yeah, I've heard a lot about the elusive photo that yeah. That Richard probably wouldn't want us discussing.
Yeah, we'll just let that go because we don't. He knows where I live, so we don't need any trouble. But, I know he knows where you live. But how'd you get that guitar?
I got that guitar through a player in town who's very, very, very good. He was actually in Itchy Brother for a little while. His name was James Harrison.
Yeah, James.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Also known as Uncle Brother. Not sure where that came from, yeah. but
They couldn't decide.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, I got a call from James. He knew I was an upcoming player, and he gave me an opportunity, a great deal on a 1978 Les Paul Standard, and
nice.
I jumped all over it. Yeah. I still had the guitar to this day. Was playing it at the house before I came here tonight.
Oh, that's so cool. That's very nice. Now, we talked a little bit about guitar. You said you didn't really take lessons. You just kind of yep. learned from the family.
Yep.
How old were you when you were like, what if we form a band? When did you kind of think, hey?
Well, I started playing out live with my dad and grandfather when I was 8 years old. Mm-hmm. Started out on drums. So it was just, you know, weekends, you know, VFW club, you know, all these country type gigs was, you know, interesting childhood to do that.
Yeah.
Every weekend. And then my dad made the mistake of letting me hear his B.B. King CD.
Uh-oh. What's B.B. King was it?
Oh, it was a live one. I remember hearing, you know, The Thrill Is Gone, How Blue Can You Get. It sounded like maybe it was from 70s or 80s. Definitely a bargain bin B.B. King.
Yeah.
But I heard that, and that just kind of that changed everything, and I started gravitating more toward the guitar and trying to get myself in a place where I could play that kind of music.
You said, I'm going to set these sticks down and pick up this over here.
Yeah, I was never any good at drums anyway.
Now, what about we're getting up to 44 Magnum? How'd that come together?
Well, I stayed in my dad and grandfather's band, which was the Kentucky Ridge Runners, all the way
up. I love that name.
It's a great name.
It's a great name.
It's a great name. Yeah. This would have been about maybe 15 or 16, and a new bass player joined the band. His name was Joe Seeley.
Uh-huh.
So started playing with him, and he got married and took a job where he had to go to Alaska or Canada or something. So he's like, well, I hate to leave y'all in this situation, so I'm going to send my brother over, John Seeley. And I pretty much, John and I became instant buddies, hung out all the time, and started dabbling with writing our own music, wanting to play different kind of music. It's like, you know, this is fun. We're tired of playing the same show every weekend and seeing the same people every weekend. We think let's see what else there is to this music thing.
Yeah. So what year are we talking that all that was going down?
Maybe around 2007.
2007. Yeah. How old are you now, if you don't mind me asking?
27.
Oh, you're just a little bitty fella.
Yeah.
And you're okay with that, right?
Oh, I'm fine with that. Yeah. I'm fine with that.
So about 2007, that's when you guys were like, hey, let's do a little band thing. Who came up with the name 44 Magnum?
I don't know what genius came up with that, but...
not necessarily a bad name, just makes you wonder.
No, I'm glad we got that out of our system. probably wouldn't fly in this day and age.
So were you guys just sitting around and going, hey man, let's just call ourselves, I don't know, 38 Special. No, wait a minute, there's already a band called that. How about 44 Magnum?
Yeah, I don't know what made us come up with that name, but when we come up with it, we was like, that's it.
This is the one. That's gold. I can see it on a t-shirt.
There you go.
Matter of fact, I seem like I remember a picture of you up here at the station with the shirt. You or somebody with a 44 Magnum shirt.
Yeah, there were some shirts, not very many, but there.
You guys actually had like some shirts made.
Yeah.
You're selling them at shows.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you guys do any recording? You know, anything that maybe has not been released. I mean, it seems like I got a CD of a couple of tunes, but
I think you pretty much have everything. We did do some recording. That band started out as me, John, a drummer in Glasgow named Cody Wooten, mm-hmm. and then a friend I had from my neck of the woods named Chai Edwards on guitar. Chai dropped out, and it went down to three-piece, and Cody left. And then for a short time, Shane Vaughn was on drums, mm-hmm. and that was when the recording happened.
Yeah. So there are some recordings of you and John with Shane and who else?
Chai.
Okay, so a couple of tunes somewhere, but they have not been released. And the reason I'm kind of covering all this is because I know you guys got a pretty good fan base building, and they're going to start looking. So we're trying to let them know that is not readily available, and please don't send me a message and ask me to make copies of mine, because I will not.
Yeah, there you go.
But we do want to let them know the history.
Yeah, you know, yeah. You gotta start somewhere.
That's right, because you never know. Someday you guys may be rich and famous and put out a box set, and you may go, you know what, man, let's put some of those 44 Magnum tunes on there.
Yeah.
You never know.
There you go.
You never know. So 44 Magnum was around for how long?
Couple years, maybe. Yeah. There wasn't a whole lot of shows. We played a little club close to home in Cave City called The Factory, and then mm-hmm. when there's a place over in Glasgow called The Venue, we played there. Just kind of, there was kind of an interesting little music scene in Glasgow at that time. Yeah. It had, like, you know, Sixth Floor and Southern Thunder and 1243 and there's a bunch of them.
Willow Shade was happening back then.
Yeah, Willow Shade, of course. Yeah, Willow Shade was great.
So there were some cool things happening back then. You guys are like, well, this is not quite exactly. And so 44 Magnum had to go, and then Otis came in. Now, I've heard that Dean Smith is the one that suggested Otis. Is that true?
Yes, it's all Dean's fault.
It's all Dean Smith.
Yeah, he said, you know, he's like, if I ever had another band, I think I'd want to call it Otis. He's like, you guys should use that.
Yeah.
And then and we're like, well, Dean Smith said it, so we obviously have to use it.
Dean's the man.
That's where Otis started. Where it was the rehearsals at Dean's house. We used to practice at his house.
Yeah, so that's been a little while. How long has that been? Like maybe, well, not quite 10 years ago. Maybe, I don't know, maybe. How long has it been?
I guess it has been about, you know, 8-9 years at least.
Since you got Otis together. Of course, you guys went through a lot of different changes. If you can remember, let's kind of throw some names out who you can recall that was in the band, just for, you know, curiosity's sake.
Mike Bull was in the band after mm-hmm. Shane. And then after Mike, Dean's son, Rhett Smith, was the drummer in the band, which got us over to rehearse at Dean's house, which was really an immense musical education for us, because that's where Rufus Huff practiced.
You got that right.
So we were, you know, we had to ticket into that. Got to hang out with everybody there.
Sure. I mean, Rufus Huff was a great band, and you guys got to kind of hang out, and they probably gave you a couple of pointers here and there. And of course, all those guys, they know all about music because they've been through it some. And so that was kind of cool that they kind of helped you along some. But, of course, you guys had your own thing going on, but it's nice they were there.
Rufus Huff was a huge influence. You know, a lot of times we would practice on the same days, and they would watch us practice, and then we'd get to watch them practice. And that's when Greg just kind of started leaving me gear over there. It's like, well, you know, as long as you stay here with it, you know, you can use this Reinhardt amp or Marshall. And sometimes he'd leave his Black Custom over there or some guitar to play, so.
Man, all those guys are good guys. Greg's a good guy. Dean's a good guy. I mean, all of them. Of course, Jared and Chris Hardesty. That was a great band right there, Rufus Huff. Really wish they'd do something else. I don't know that they will, but at least we got an album out of them, so that's nice.
Yeah, I wish we could just convince them to put that album out on vinyl. That'd sound great.
Oh, wouldn't that be nice?
That'd be nice.
That would be sweet. But of course, he's got the Greg Marr group now, and they've done a little 45 action. So I don't know. You never know with those guys.
It could happen.
It could happen. Yeah.
As long as Greg and Dean's on it, you can count on me buying it.
There you go. You know, absolutely. Me too. You got that right. So Otis was kind of happening there about 10 years or so ago. We named off some of the folks that have been through the band, but of course, the big thing was when you guys added Steve, because that's kind of when Steve and, of course, Andrew, that's when you guys really started to mesh, I would say. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, we really took off when we added Steve in the band. The only thing that we had released before Steve was a small EP that was just me, John, and Andrew. And actually, at the release party, I invited Steve out to jam, and that was at the Twisted Tap. So that's how long ago that's been. But
I was just talking to somebody about that the other day. We could not remember the name of the place, Twisted Tap, over here on the square.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So it was the three of you. You guys were doing a kind of release party, and he was a buddy of yours. He said, "Man, you should come to the show." And then you brought him up.
Yeah, I said, "Man, come to the show. We'll get you up to jam or something." And we got him up to jam, and immediately Steve and I started doing guitar harmonies. We were, you know, playing off each other, and then that opened up a whole nother world for John and Andrew. And it kind of after that point, it's like, well, we can't really go back to being a three piece after that.
Yeah. Now, when you guys added the second guitar player, I'm sure that kind of freed things up a little bit. For you, didn't it, being the lead vocalist?
Oh, it made my job a lot easier because for those of you who've played in a power trio three-piece band, it will work you to death. You know, trying to pull all that stuff off and sing, and it's not for everybody.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, years ago when you and I first kind of started getting to know each other, and of course things kind of went slow with 44 Magnum and the early years of Otis. You guys would play a show, and then it seemed like you were quiet for a while, and there was even a time or two where I was thinking maybe Otis wasn't even around anymore, and it's just because you guys were just kind of like, well, this is happening, then nothing, then this is happening, and I just kept thinking, and I know that I told you, I said, stick with it, because you got something.
I remember a long time ago, you told me that. I think the first time I met you was at a show at Glasgow High School. I think maybe Eighth Nation was playing, and that's the first time I'd run into you.
Yeah, I remember that show. But who else was there? Eighth Nation and who else?
It was we were 44 Magnum at the time.
44 Magnum. There was like three or four bands that night, wasn't it?
Yeah, I can't remember who else played, but I remember, you know, you gave me a little pep talk, a little kick in the butt, and I was like, well, you know, maybe we can do this.
Well, the thing of it is, I mean, you're a great guitar player, but for me, it's your voice. I mean, like I said, I love your guitar playing, but first thing that hit me is I was like, that dude's voice is unique. There's something there. And, of course, now we're all getting to enjoy it through the releases through the band.
There you go, man. I definitely needed the encouragement on the vocals, you know, when I started out. You know, people's like, man, I don't know if you want to be singing or not.
Oh, you're perfect.
but I just kept singing anyway. And, and here we are. But
So okay. So you go. Let's go back because we got people going. Man, stay with it. We want to know more. We're gonna give them more. So you got the lineup together. Everybody's meshing. Things are going. And then you guys go in the studio for that first release. How did all that come about?
That was all really cool. We started. You know, the thing about the early days of Otis, the reason we wasn't playing a whole lot of shows or doing much out because we were rehearsing. We rehearse, you know, at least three or four nights a week. We'd take weekends, you know, a 12-hour rehearsal.
Yeah.
You know, because you had a new band member in, and we were all just getting to know each other musically, and we had all these things we wanted to accomplish and do. So all our time was spent kind of honing our craft, learning how to be a band, learning how to write songs, you know, any chance that we got to spend, you know, with Rufus Huff or Blackstone Cherry, the Headhunters, we was doing that and getting those lessons that we could use later. And then we got to the point where, like, all right, we got a good little bunch of songs up here. Let's call Brother Greg and see if he wants to come over and listen and give us any pointers. So he did, and we had, you know, wrote a couple songs even with Greg, and he'd come over and listen, and he's like, well, we should take this in the studio. So the first time we were in the studio as Otis, this would have been pre, you know, the John Brim record. So we just did like a small EP. We never released it. It was just kind of a promotional thing, you know, to get us gigs and just shoot around to industry people. That turned out really cool. Of course, we recorded that with David Barrick. That was when he was in the old White House over on Industrial in Glasgow next to the train tracks.
Yeah, yeah. So. A lot of folks recorded there at that studio, that's for sure. Well, a lot of folks have recorded with him, period, throughout the years. I mean, when he puts his finger on it, it sounds pretty damn good.
Oh, yeah. David's the man as far as that stuff goes.
You got that right. So you guys went in the studio, and if I recall, you put that in like a press kit. That's what you were talking about, right?
Yeah.
Photo with the band, little bio. I think I've got a couple of those. Again, no, you can't have those. Those are your listening. Those are my personal collection. I'm sorry. But so you guys recorded that, and not long after that, I guess that's when you went in. Now, how did the whole idea come about of doing a full CD of someone else's music?
Well, Greg had called me. He said, won't you and Steve meet me over at Big Moose's? So we're like, all right, Big Moose's with Greg, barbecue, wisdom, sounds good. So we went over there, and Greg's like, man, I just thought of something that I run across, and he was going through the whole John Brim story. Of course, John Brim was a blues guy from Kentucky. In his teens, he moved to Chicago, recorded on Chess Records, you know, with Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Little Walter, all the big blues names, but he never really got the notoriety. I mean, he even had a good blues career all the way up into his 80s. What really made it for him was the song Ice Cream Man. Mm-hmm. Van Halen cut it on their first record, from the royalties of that, the story goes that he was able to buy his own record store, and that's what he did the rest of his life. Just played with, it was John Brim and the Ice Cream Man, and then he wrote his, he ran his own record store for the rest of his life. And, you know, it became something really passionate to us, because when you mention music in Kentucky, you know, the first thing people think of is, you know, bluegrass and country music, which makes sense. But there's still a lot of blues heritage in Kentucky, as Greg's says that we're in that perfect melting pot spot, you know. Yeah. We got you got Chicago not far from us. Right. You got Memphis. You know, we're in that perfect spot between the Delta and Chicago to get all those good blues influences.
That's right. That's right.
And then he said, "Won't you just take one of his songs and work it up and see if it fits, and then send that to me, and we'll talk."
What do you remember? What that first song was?
I think it may have been either Tough Times or Drinking Woman, because he gave me like, you know, three or four burnt CDs that were all through, you know, John Brim's career. He said, just go on there and find something, fix up arrangement to it, and lay some vocals down and send it to me, and we'll go from there. Mm-hmm. And then the original idea was to just put it out as an EP. Mm-hmm. Well, we got in the studio for the first half of the session, and it just clicked off. It was all live. It felt really good. Mm-hmm. We identified that those recordings had a particular sound that we hadn't heard on any other record. It's kind of like, it's been kind of like a rock band, you know, going into Chess and cutting old blues songs. It still had that early 50s Chicago blues sound that's kind of what we were searching for. And then we decided that it was good enough. Hey, let's just go on. Let's pick out some more songs and make a record out of this.
Yeah. You're like, EP be damned. Let's do a full-on CD.
Yeah. It was feeling too good to just do an EP. We knew we kind of hit something that struck a nerve.
Now, that was, I remember the early winter. Was that like 2013, 14, somewhere around in there?
Yeah, that would be right.
Yeah, because I remember that at that time, Dave had the new studio that was up at, I don't remember what exit number it is, but it's like the second exit when you're headed to Glasgow from Bowling Green when you get on the parkway there.
Yeah, it used to be an auction barn.
Yeah, the barn. So
you could imagine how good that felt in the wintertime around the kerosene heaters.
Well, sure. I mean, when I remember when you guys had me up there, we were all kind of sitting around in light coats inside, because even though we was inside and there was heaters, we were like, well, I'm going to go ahead and keep this jacket on. And I remember I took some photos of you guys, and one of them, when you're in the booth, you have a jacket on.
yeah. It was cold in there, but you know, for all you recording science nerds, being recording in that cold of a temperature really does something to those guitar amps. Those guitar amps are sounding mean. Of course, we wouldn't use no big Marshalls or anything. We were really trying to stay authentic to the blues. So Greg brought up like some, you know, late 40s, you know, Fender amps, and I had like a 50s Gibson chained to it.
So nice.
We were just up there freezing to death, having a big time.
Yeah, and you had a couple of visitors.
We did. It got to a certain point on the record, and it's kind of like, you know what, this needs some harmonica. And then you know, of course, conversation didn't take very long to wind around to Jimmy Hall. Uh-huh. And Jimmy just lives in Nashville, so Greg got on the phone with Jimmy, and then he was up the next day, and that was quite a experience that day as well, to work with Jimmy in the studio.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd seen Jimmy live. I've been around Jimmy quite a bit, and I, you know, he's like family to us. Yeah. So getting to work in the studio with him was cool. You know, he would come in there, do a first take, and we're like, oh yeah, that's it. And
yeah.
Then he'd be like, man, I don't know. I don't think that one had it. Let's do two or three more, and then we'd always end up going with the first one.
But, yeah.
But he wanted to give it, you know, and give it everything he had.
Well, he was trying to do right by you.
That's right. That's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Jimmy Hall's one of those that, man, he's just talented as all get out. You're like, man, I get to sit in a room and maybe breathe some same air as Jimmy Hall. I'll be there.
Yep. Remember he first come into the studio, you know, if you've ever been around Jimmy, he's a very high energy guy, very high strung. So he's carrying his stuff in there. Then I'm just sitting there on a couch, and then Greg's in a chair. He's like, you know what? I'm going to sit by this guy. He seems grounded. He said, I need to calm down.
Cool deal. Of course, he plays a little bit of everything. And some, I guess, folks, of course, know him from Wet Willie, and he's done a lot of touring with Jeff Beck. And
oh, yeah.
He's just done everything.
And a lot of people don't know he's the band leader for Hank Williams Jr. as well. When Hank Jr. tours. And he was on the Jeff Beck Flash album, Wet Willie stuff. Still touring with Jeff Beck. Mm-hmm. If you ever run across the album Live Plus, be sure to get it. It's pretty incredible. Got Jimmy on the vocals.
There you go. Everybody check that out. So, you're in the studio. Jimmy comes in. Now, was Jimmy just in for one day?
Yeah. It was just a few hours. We'd done had all the tracks laid out, so it didn't work out for him to come do it with us. We'd have probably been too tore up for that at that point anyway, as far as, you know. Playing a live track with Jimmy Hall would have been stressful, but he just come in and nailed those parts, and he really did love what we were doing. You know, he said, man, this sounds like Can't Heat, or this sounds like Humble Pie, and he was like, man, I can't believe you guys are into the blues like this. This is so cool. And then Greg's just looking around like, I told you. It is very unorthodox for a band's first album to be, you know, all somebody else's music, but it really turned out well.
Yes, it did.
In a sense, we kind of gave ourselves our own artist development and gave ourselves a couple of years to learn how to write our own music better, record our own music better. Yeah. So when it was finally time to go do the, you know, the first label release, you know, we were ready to go.
Well, see, that's the thing. Like I said, I'm not a player, so I didn't really catch all that. But you guys are like winking at me the whole time going, it's all going to be good, brother. Just hang in there.
You know Greg was feeding us these ideas, and he knew what he was doing.
Yeah, of course.
Greg's slick.
Yeah, well, yeah. But, I mean, I was just always like, these boys are good.
Yeah.
I want them to do good.
Oh, yeah.
And I've
told plenty of people, you know, you were probably our first friend in the music industry. You've always helped us along. The first person to ever play us on the radio, and
was that the first person to ever play you?
Yeah.
I know that you were on Home Cooking one time, and it was the one where you guys were announcing you were no longer 44 Magnum, you're Otis.
Yeah,
you had changed the name.
Yep, you were. That's Home Cooking was the first place to ever play us.
Yeah, I still think you guys need to redo Prowler.
Hey, that's always in the back of our mind. That's actually, it's funny you mentioned that. Me and Steve got together today and was going through, you know, old songs that we had recorded off other demos and stuff and writing. It's just like we got so much music sometimes we just don't know what to do with it.
But I think really probably that's a good thing, right?
Oh, it's a great thing. You know, when you go in to do an album and you got 50 songs to look at.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But then you got to cut it down to your, you know, 10 or 11 or what have you. And that's the hard part. You know?
Yeah. So the Tough Times came out, and what'd you think? What happened? What did people think? I mean, I know what people around here, but I'm sure you guys got a lot of feedback from folks out there in the world. And some famous friends were digging it, right?
Oh, yeah. We were very, very, very fortunate. Of course, we didn't, as far as releasing the album, we really didn't know what we were doing because we'd never released an album before. Yeah. So we got a 1,000 copies off CD Baby and just started, you know, we had them where you could buy them online. We had them out on the road with us. And of course, at Mellow Mats where we did our, you know, our first CD release there. And the response was really, really great. Except from the blues community of all things, which I always thought was kind of funny because we're like, you know, that's kind of the reason that we went this direction. It's like, man, Greg's like, all these blues people are gonna love it, and then they were kind of like, well, you know, this is a little heavy, you know,
wrong with that?
Yeah. So we actually got a whole lot more love from the rock and roll community for that album than we did the blues. But I'll tell you what was really cool recently on our YouTube account, we got a message from John Brim Jr.
Nice.
And he said, man, I think my dad would have loved you guys, and I wish he was still around to see it, and thank you for promoting the blues heritage. And we're like,
oh, that's nice.
We're like, that's the reason we made the record there.
Yeah.
But to get back to your question, we got some really nice response from it, and the songs translated well live, and people seem to really dig what we were doing, and even got it in the hands of Billy Gibbons.
That's right. He put his stamp of approval on it, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah.
It was a completely natural thing, too, and it was not planned at all. Greg and I were down in Nashville. We were on our way back, and the phone rings, and Greg shows it over to me. It was Billy F. Gibbons.
Yeah.
And Greg answers the phone. He's like, hey, what's going on, Billy? And then this was around the time that Dusty had some trouble with his hip. So they had just got off tour like the night before. Mm. So he said, Greg, I'm in Nashville, and you want to come hang? And we were already about halfway home. And
he said, hell yeah!
Yeah. Whipped it back around and went to Nashville and hung out with him and his wife, had dinner with him. And just sat around and talked to Billy for hours. And, Billy is probably one of the most high-profile, rock and rollers I've been around, and he's probably the most down to earth. He was, asking Greg and I, how we set our Marshalls and, what blues albums we've been listening to. And it's like, no, man, I think we want to ask you.
Yeah.
And of course, we were going back and forth. He was talking about recording the live side of Fandango and how he set his Marshalls doing that.
Oh, how cool.
And what records, they were listening to at the time, and talking about Dusty playing with Freddie King, getting to spend some time with Freddie King, so just all this cool stuff. And we were getting ready to leave, and Greg's like, Billy, this is Boone's band, band's Otis, and this is cool little blues record. You might enjoy it. So it was, there was no pressure. We were leaving. We were just passed it along to him, and he said that cover's killer. He said that's a real blues man cover right there. Uh-huh. He said I'm gonna listen to this, and Greg will hear back from me. So I thought, I kind of thought, probably won't hear much out of this. Couple days, got an email from Billy just going on and on about the record, how much he loved it. He wanted to talk to the engineer,
mm-hmm.
wanted to talk to us about it, and he said, really authentic stuff. Gave us a nice press quote to use, and we've kind of stayed in touch with Billy ever since. He got where he was mentioning us in a podcast about two or three times a week a couple months ago. So we got some nice traction from that, and. I got to visit with Billy again. My wife and I went to see ZZ Top and Blackberry Smoke at the Biltmore in North Carolina.
Yeah.
And I told Greg I was going. He's like, well, I'll see if I can get you back. He said it may or may not work out. But it did work out. Billy's like, yeah, I'd love to have him send him back. So got to visit with Billy again and talk about more old records and guitars. And he's keeping up with the band and just very humbled by that whole experience. Yeah.
I guarantee you, when you were sitting there having dinner the whole time, you're going, holy shit, that's Billy Gibbons. Holy shit, that's Billy Gibbons.
the cool thing about watching him is, if you're Billy Gibbons, you can't hide from being Billy Gibbons.
No.
I mean, he's the beard. He's mm-hmm. he's got stage clothes on anytime mm-hmm. he goes out.
He's got that hat.
Yeah, and people were, stopping by every couple minutes, and mm-hmm. he was completely cool about it. He'd just whip out his Sharpie from mm-hmm. his coat pocket, write them an autograph, and send them on their way. And this one guy said, man, you take a picture where it looks like you're choking me? And he's like, sure. So he got up, done it, sat back down.
He's like, whatever, man.
Finished his dinner. I was like, man, this is pretty cool.
We ran into him a few years back at LAX. And I was talking to him a little bit, and come to find out, he was right. He was on the same plane we were on. Right. And there wasn't a lot of people on that flight because, like I said, we were coming back from NAMM. Some of the guys from the metal band Accept were up front on the plane, and Billy and his wife Gilligan were towards the back, and we were in the back. So basically, he was sitting right beside us the whole flight. And we talked to him a little bit before the flight, but we didn't want to bother him, because he was there with his wife. So we really didn't bother him at all during the flight. And then we did say something to him when we got off the flight. But I saw him pulling out the pen, and he had little post-it notes or something with him. And people ask for his autograph, and he'd pull it out, sign it, hand it to him. He was prepared.
He's so personable. Like, both times I saw him, he sent me home with, like, this burn disc of blues songs. He'll write Billy's Blues Mix, and, you know, to Boone or to Greg or whatever. Yeah. He would send it with us, and we found out through Jimmy Hall that he was burning copies of our first album and just handing them out to people. Like, hey, man, check out this band. They're really good.
He's trying to do what he can to help you out.
Yeah, like I said, the whole band is very humbled. You know, that's our absolute, you know, guitar hero. I can't tell you how many ZZ Top records I've owned, you know, coming up in a band. And
of course,
they're the you know, the sound of Texas.
You got that right. You can't be a true music lover unless you got at least one ZZ Top album.
Not just a Eliminator either.
Exactly. Matter of fact, it needs to not be a Eliminator. That's for sure. But that particular CD, you had 1,000 of them pressed up, and I guess they're all gone.
They're all gone. Yeah. There's some folks selling them on eBay for, you know, kind of some upward money these
days.
And you know, I see a lot of people come up and tell me, well, you know, we went and bought this record on eBay.
Yeah.
So we're at some point in our career, that's going to be put back out.
Yeah.
I promise you that.
Yeah. So you did that for a while. You guys did some touring, and then things changed. And next thing you know, you guys are signing with a label. Give us a little bit of information about how all that came about.
We were very fortunate. You know, we went out and got to play a lot of shows. You know, this area is a musical family, and we were, you know, very lucky and humbled to play many, many shows with the Kentucky Headhunters and Blackstone Cherry, or maybe if Greg was doing a solo project. So we did a lot of that, you know, and through doing that, that kind of built us up a resume. You know, Jimmy Hall, when Wet Willie would play Macon, he would have us come down and open for that. We played at Jimmy Hall's birthday bash there, I think like 3 years in a row. So kind of got some steam rolling up, got some management, got lucky enough to get on Cleopatra Records for our debut release.
Yeah. So the new album has been out for, is it pushing a year? It's getting close, isn't it?
It was September 15th of last year.
Okay, so
the record came out.
By the time they hear this, it'll probably be 1 year since that was released. Of course, this album, all original?
Yeah, there's only one cover on there, and that's a cover of a country song, actually.
Yeah.
Stonewall Jackson's Wash My Hands in Muddy Water.
Yeah. So you guys went back to Barrick?
We did. We went into David's. We, you know, put our big boy pants on and cut it all to tape, which, you know, we were all really excited about.
Oh,
that.
So this time you went with the real deal. You went with tape.
Yeah. We were. We didn't quite think we were ready when we did the John Brim album to cut to tape.
Yeah.
Because it is a process, and you've got to be on your toes. I mean, everything's basically live.
Yeah.
Cut live.
Now, explain to folks listening right now, if they don't understand what that means, explain the difference of what we're talking about here.
The difference between cutting the Pro Tools and cutting the tape is anytime you make a mistake recording the tape has to be wiped off, and then you got to, you know, rewind it.
Yeah.
And do that whole thing. With Pro Tools, I mean, you can make as many mistakes as you want, and it's just simple as hitting a button and clicking a mouse, and your mistake is gone.
So Pro Tools is basically recording on a computer, and tape, you're actually using tape like they did originally before they came up with all these programs you can use on computer. And so you're saying a tape is quite a bit more expensive and time-consuming.
More expensive and time-consuming. There's less room for error, and... you know, you got to have your stuff together. You can't do things, you know, one instrument or one track at a time. You know, what we would do, we would do the whole band take on tape, and then any overdubs we did, we would do on Pro Tools and dump it back over into tape.
Gotcha.
So you had the same sound and saturation, but you had the freedom, you know, of the editing with Pro Tools.
Cool. Now, of course, when you go to tape, what is the advantage of going to tape?
Natural compression. It's automatically, you know, you start sounding like all the records that you've grew up listening to, and it's there. You can tell it, especially in drums and guitars. Vocals not as much, but, you know, instrumentation absolutely.
Yes,
you
know. Tape's the way to go. So you guys went to tape.
Yep.
full album, one cover tune, the rest all originals. Were these all tunes that you guys wrote on the road, or some of these tunes that have been around for a while?
Some of the tunes have been around for a while, and some of them we wrote on the road. It's kind of hard to keep up with. We do a lot of rehearsing, and a lot of these were just written just live on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, either I would bring in a riff, or Steve would bring in a riff, or we would just come up with it there. But yeah, some of the songs had been around for a minute.
Yeah. So that came out a year ago now, and in the past couple of months, it's been pressed on vinyl.
It has. We're super proud of that, because I've always been a big vinyl junkie. I think that's the ultimate way to listen to music. And, you know, and it's an honor to be on the same format as all my heroes.
Sure, absolutely. Of course, you guys have been doing a lot of touring behind the release of the latest, that is Eyes of the Sun. Those of you out there, maybe someone doesn't have it. The first release from you guys, Otis, was Tough Times. And then the second is Eyes of the Sun, which is the one that was released about a year ago. And that's the one we're talking about that's released on vinyl. And I'm sure if their folks are still looking for it, they can still get that on vinyl, right?
Oh, yeah, it's readily available.
Yeah.
Go see Brother Mellow Matt over on Small House Road and get it, or there's plenty of places you can get it on the internet.
Yeah.
I was over at Mellow Matt's today, and there's still two signed copies.
Oh, so he's still got two signed copies
of
that on vinyl.
Yeah.
Okay, so folks, we're recording this about 2 weeks before you're hearing it, but hopefully he's still got it. Just give him a call. Heck, I'll give you the number, 270-780-0068. And if they still got one, you better get it in your collection for show. Now, let's talk a little bit about being on the road. You guys have done some extensive touring as far, you know, before you guys would, you know, maybe go on to Nashville, maybe go up to Louisville, Lexington, maybe go down to Macon. But you guys actually bought the van, and you guys booked all the way out to California and back, basically, didn't you?
Yeah, we sure did. We bought that van, and then the next Monday we drove it to Connecticut to fly out to go to Europe. So
You know what? Let's talk about Europe. Let's talk about how all that came about.
Yeah, like, as soon as we released our latest record, Eyes of the Sun, things started happening. We got a European booking agency as well as a U.S. booking agency, and we got lucky enough to go over and do a 2-week tour in Europe, and getting four good old, you know, Kentucky country boys and going to Europe is it's an undertaking. Just an amazing experience. And we were getting on the plane in New York, and we got a text from John Fred, and he said, "What time do you boys start tomorrow night?" And we're like, we thought he was just carrying on, John Fred being John Fred.
Yeah.
And so we were talking to him. He was like, "No, man, I'm serious. We're over here doing some press, and we want to try to plan it where we come see you guys when you get to London."
Isn't that nice, man?
Yeah. So that about got us down right there.
Yeah. Like,
this is we're really humbled by that. This is really cool. So we fly over there and land in London, and there's a snowstorm on. For you people that's familiar with London, that don't happen a whole lot.
Yeah, so. You know, I talked to Big Dave about that, and he wanted to make that show, but he couldn't make that show because of the weather. And he said, "Dude, you don't understand it. Don't ever do that."
Yeah, that's what everybody was saying. You know, it was such a strange view, you know, coming down and flying into a snow-covered London. You know, the town was pretty much shut down. There wasn't a whole lot of movement, and I'm sure it did affect our turnout next night. That was first show of the tour in London at the Boston Music Room, but it was really cool that Blackstone Cherry was there. They came in and brought a whole lot of folks with them, and you know, we got there to set up that day and looked on the wall and said, you know, Live Nation presents Otis, and that was kind of that was a moment. It's like, well. Yeah. We done gone and done it, our first Live Nation show.
Yeah. How cool is that? So you guys were over there for a couple of weeks. Where all did you visit as far as countries and stuff like that?
We were all over. Of course, we only got to do one show in the UK. We didn't get to spend very much time there, but we got to do, you know, Germany, the Netherlands, Austria, and just it was an experience seeing all that beautiful country over there. And just a whole different experience. The most humbling thing for me was the audiences. You would, once you started playing, nobody got on a cell phone, nobody went to get a beer, nobody made a sound until, unless it was between songs. And you know, no offense to the crowds we have here at home, but it was a whole new kind of reverence for us for a rock and roll show. And but at the same time, it kind of felt like we were home, because people would show up, you know, Allman Brothers t-shirts, Headhunters, of course, Blackstone Cherry. And everybody wanted to talk about Blackstone Cherry over there, of course.
Jeez, I wonder why.
Yeah, I know, right?
So that's cool. So y'all spent a couple of weeks over there and had a good time, and I'm sure at some point you guys will probably make another trip over that way.
Oh, we'd love to, and it'll definitely happen. And there's been some live recording of that tour, so I got to get some of that to you, let you check it out.
Yeah, you know I won't check that out, man.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you did mention Blackstone Cherry. You guys have done some shows with them, and you've got some other shows coming up. Let's talk a little bit about how those shows in the past came together, and what's that like being on the road with those boys?
It's, like I said, this music community we have, you know, Bowling Green, Glasgow, truly is a family. You know, we'll just... We'll get a text from one of them, say, hey, you guys want to go out and do some dates? Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Let's make it happen.
Yeah.
And they're always very, very kind to us. And it's seeing that lineup musically, taking it around for the people has to be a very special show, because you can definitely tell that there's some family there. There's you know, one thing is connected to another, and it's been a great opportunity for us, because it gets us out to more of a active rock, modern rock audience, and that's something that we hadn't been exposed to, and figuring out how to tweak our shows and our performance for those people, and then still be the same Otis that you see anywhere else.
Absolutely,
it's been a really cool thing, and it's been a cool thing for them too, because you know we start bringing the people that normally see us come to a Blackstone Cherry show, which is a little more mellow people. So it's getting to turn each other's audience onto the bands has been really cool.
That's a good thing.
And you know, just hanging out with them all day, you know, getting to come out and jam, and just their wisdom, being around them is just great.
Yeah,
it's great.
That's very cool. Now, let's go back for just a second. As far as when you were a little bit younger, and when you were in like 44 Magnum and Otis, stuff like that, some local bands that maybe influenced you. I'm sure Blackstone Cherry was one of those.
Oh, absolutely. Goes without saying it. Kentucky Headhunters, Blackstone Cherry, Rufus Huff, Super Fuzz was a huge, huge influence on what we do. And it was really cool on our when we did our out west portion of the tour, West Coast, we got to go out and stay with David Angstrom for a couple of days in Colorado, which was really cool, because he's the only one that came out of this our little musical community and done really well that I haven't got to spend much time with. It was great spending those couple of days with Dave and see he was just like the rest of us.
Yeah. So that was cool when you guys were out that way. He kind of said, look, man, y'all don't have to worry about a hotel and all. Y'all can just crash here. It's all good.
Yeah, he said just crash here for a couple of days. Yeah. We'll jam all day, and then we'll go do our show together that night. Of course, we played with Luna Soul when we were in Colorado.
His latest project, yeah.
Yeah, and we came in the door, you know, it just started hitting it off, just like, you know, just walking into Dean Smith's house or practice house or wherever. And I think it kind of freaked his wife out. He's like, she's like, you know, oh, you were just exactly alike. You know, what's going on?
Yeah, well, we're kind of from the same area, you know, Kentucky there. Yeah. You know,
so we had some you know, good laughs over knowing the same type of people and the same type of music. And, you know, he was telling us plenty of good Dean Smith stories that we'd never heard before.
Uh-huh.
So we had a great time hanging out with Dave. It was a special thing.
That was really cool that he did that. Now, when you guys were out west running around, any places that you were out there and you're like, man, this is all right, or there's some places maybe you're like, I don't think we ever want to come back here, man.
there's a few of those. There's always going to be a few of those when you do a big extensive tour like that. But for the most part, we really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed you know, Arizona and New Mexico, just you know, us just driving through the desert, you know, listening to Marty Stewart and Graham Parsons and having that whole experience, and then going through LA listening to all the stuff that, you know, was recorded around there, you know, like a lot of soul music and Beach Boys and all that whole thing. So
did you guys do any sightseeing when you were out there anywhere? Did you have time to go anywhere and say, man, we gotta go over and check this out?
We stopped a couple places, but just, you know, looking out the window was just amazing to us, because we'd never been in that part of the United States, and it's something to see. It was cool. We played in Arizona. This guy named Bill Piper came to the show, and he's like a Headhunters mega fan. So getting to spend some time with him was cool. I'd first met Bill when Steve and I had fill in for Greg in the Kentucky Headhunters, and I met Bill down in Louisiana. So he's a guy that's willing to drive from Arizona to Louisiana.
Wow.
From Arizona to Indiana to see a Headhunter show.
And dang,
that's something I really admire, because I think a lot of folks around here fall into, you know, well, I can see them next year, or I can see them in 6 months.
Yeah.
And, you know, you should never do that to somebody that's that deserving.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's cool. Now, what we need to get to now is we need to talk about the future of Otis. Do you guys have anything working right now? Are you still just, can't you know, kind of focusing on touring on this latest release?
We're focusing on touring the latest release, but we are kind of in the process of doing some pre-production for the next record. I mean, I think if everything lined up, you know, we could go and cut the record tonight. You know,
oh, really? You think do you guys have enough material right now?
Definitely. We're just trying to get everything, you know, lined up, you know, business wise, find the right producer, right environment, and go from there. And then, you know, this current album cycle, I think, still has a lot of life. Still a lot of people we ain't got to see yet. So we're on a new booking agency, so the dates are coming in, and you know, getting ready to hit the road again. Next week we're doing the Easy Riders Motorcycle Rodeo. Mm-hmm. That'll be fun. And then September we're doing a show in Edmonton with the Kentucky Headhunters, and then heading out on the road with Blackstone Cherry for some dates. So there's a lot going on.
Yeah, things are still happening, still popping with Otis.
Oh yeah.
Now, where are you guys at on the web, where folks can find you on the internet there?
www.theotisband.com, and we, of course, again, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all that stuff. But you know, if you go to the website, that'll hook you up to all of it. The online store, the social media links, that'll get you all of it.
Yeah. Now let me ask you this, just because I'm curious.
All right.
Just some stuff off the top of my head. Give me like 3 all-time favorite albums. They don't have to be the best, but give me 3 that you're like, dude, that's one of them. Give me 3. It can be anything, really.
All right, the Kentucky Headhunter Soul. Mm-hmm. That's always been a really special record to me.
I think
they had the good stuff going on that album.
Is that your favorite from the Heads?
Today.
Okay, yeah, so Kentucky Headhunter Soul. All right, what else?
Yeah, let's see here. Man, this is a tough question. It's put me on the spot a little bit.
Yeah, if you can't think of 3 records, think of, how about 3 bands?
Oh, 3 bands. That's pretty easy. Kentucky Headhunters, James Brown, and Marty Stewart and the Fabulous Superlatives.
There you go.
That's today.
Yeah, but I mean, that's a pretty wide range there.
Yeah.
I mean, you got James Brown, and it's kind of R&B soul, and then you got Marty, which is a little more country. Then you got the Heads, that they say country, but I don't know, man. A little more rock and roll as far as I'm concerned.
Oh yeah, that's a rock and roll show for sure.
Yeah. And then you mentioned a little bit earlier, you're talking about that the blues folks, when you first put that first album out, Tough Times, they were kind of like, I don't know, it's bluesy, but it's not. Made me think when you were talking about that, the Headhunters, how they picking on Nashville, how the country fans are kind of like, well, I don't know, it's a little too rocking for country. But, you know, you hear those guys talk about when that first one came out, they kind of got a little of that too. So in a way, you should be proud.
we are very proud, and I think that us and the Headhunters got turned down by the same CEO of the same label, so I felt pretty proud of that. We still have that rejection letter hung up.
Well, a lot of the greats have had plenty of those rejection letters, right?
Oh, yeah. You know, at least somebody's talking to us, you know?
Yeah. All right, so we talked about records a little bit, talked about bands a little bit. Guitar players. Give me some guitar players that folks should check out. Some of them they may know of. Some of them maybe they're like, I never thought about that dude.
Man, you know, everybody in Otis loves guitar players. Yeah. You know, we're a very, very guitar-oriented band, I think. Mm-hmm. One of my big ones here lately has been Bo Diddley. I think he was a very, very underrated player. Uh-huh. And once you start going back and listening to that stuff, it's like, man, especially with him using one of those tremolo amps, it sounds like a freight train, you know, mm-hmm. coming through your living room.
Yeah.
You know, it's very, very amazing stuff. And being what it is today, Ed King.
Yeah,
I've always been a huge, huge fan of Ed King.
Yeah, of course, he just passed away. So, yeah. Did you get a chance to meet Ed?
I did. Back a couple of years ago, he did some shows with Dixie Tabernacle, which was a band that's Larry Goad and Doug Phelps, and Greg was setting in with them. They did two nights. They did a night at the Plaza in Glasgow, and then they did a show in Murfreesboro, and I got to kind of go along and be Greg's guitar tech for those 2 days, which I'm very, very grateful for. You know, Ed King kind of had the reputation that he was kind of the Archie Bunker of rock and roll, and I'd heard that several times, so I was like, I'm going to really, you know, watch myself being around Ed.
What, that he was like kind of grumpy or something?
Yeah, he was a little grumpy, and I knew that he'd had the heart transplant, he can't, you know, shake hands and do that.
Just trying to be careful, yeah.
But you know, he was so nice to me, and I learned mm-hmm. so much from him in that 2 days. And I always really respected Ed, because he's the only person I could think of that came from the whole the L.A. Free spirit type rock and roll movement, and came in to Southern rock.
Yeah.
And I always think that's a really cool background, and the guitar parts he played were always so perfectly placed.
Yeah,
and I really, really admire Ed.
Do you have a favorite Ed King maybe tune that he co-wrote? A lot of people, sadly, only they think, well, he wrote "Sweet Home Alabama." Well, that's true, but he actually co-wrote quite a few Lynyrd Skynyrd tunes. Do you have a favorite that he plays on? How about that?
Price Swamp Music. That opening riff is Ed, and that's such an amazing, amazing lick. And he also played bass on the first album. A lot of people don't know that.
Talented guy he was.
Yeah. Very very lucky to meet him. Yeah. Guitar geek through and through. I enjoyed that side of him, because he owned Greg's 58 first.
That's right. That's a story that maybe not a lot of people know. Yeah,
and that got passed on to Hank Jr., which got passed on to Greg. So around the time that those two shows are going on was around the time that Gibson had released Collector's Choice 15, which is Greg's signature model. So
yeah.
You know, he had one of the CC-15s Ed did that he brought with him, and he wanted to compare it to the real thing. He's like, I've owned this guitar like three times. So he was, going through, well, that screw's different, or, yeah. You know.
That's really cool. The guitar that Greg has that originally belonged to Ed, and then Greg has that series come out. Ed gets one of those guitars, and then he's comparing that guitar to the actual guitar that he once owned.
Yeah, so it was a...
It's like Twilight Zone or something.
Yeah, it was a very, very cool moment to be a fly on the wall.
Yeah, very cool. So, all right, man, we're going to keep our fingers crossed for Otis. We're looking forward to some new music, hopefully the next couple of years. But, as you said, the album that's just been released just like a year ago now,
yeah.
Eyes of the Sun, still got some legs, still going to be going. You guys still got some touring to do, and you're going to be out doing that. But, man, what about this fan base that's building? How nice is that?
Oh, that's one of the most humbling things out of all this, is to see, you know, when you go out and step out on stage, and you know that there's people that's came from, you know, other states just to see you, just to be a part of what you do, and then see all the people that come to the shows, they become friends and family, and you know, they bring you stuff, and it's just like, it's kind of like having a little bit of family everywhere you go.
Isn't that nice?
You know, we don't like to refer to anyone as a fan. We always either do, you know, friends or family. So
yeah,
it's been really nice to experience that level of support.
Yeah. Well, Boone, you and I have known each other for a while.
Oh yeah.
And I think a lot of you, and I love you, and you got a hell of a band, brother.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So big thanks to you for stopping in today. And also, we want to send some love out to Brother Steve and Andrew and John, the four of you come together to make a hell of a band. And folks, jump on the web. Give them the website again.
www.theotisband.com.
Okay. And remember, if you go in a record store, folks, and you see that Tough Time CD, you better grab it. Because that sucker is gone. But I know every once in a while I want to pop in over at Mellow Matt's, but it don't sit there very long. Usually it sits on the counter for about 10 minutes. And then somebody sees it and goes, hey, is that for sale? I've seen it happen with my own eyes. And so, yeah, if you ever run into an Otis Tough Time CD, you better get it. Because, like I said, you can't get those really no more. So we'll be watching for that. Anything else before we close it out? You want to say anything about anything?
Man, I just want to thank you for having me over and just being a great friend for all these years. I've learned a lot from being around you about how to approach people and treat people, and I always appreciate that.
Well, cool. Now, are you still doing the radio show?
I am.
Go ahead and plug your radio show real quick.
My family owns a little radio station, 99.1 The Hoss. That'd be WHSX. You can find us on the TuneIn app. I do a show called Rockin' Roots from 8 to 10 every Saturday night. So if you feel inclined, come over and listen to me ramble a little bit.
Okay, so every Saturday night, 8 to 10. And what's the frequency again?
99.1 WHSX.
And that is where again?
Edmonton.
All right, everybody, check that out. All right, Boone, thank you so much for stopping in today. Folks, again, make sure you get your Otis CD, the latest release, Eyes of the Sun, in stores now. And as you heard, it's available on vinyl, but you better get them because I guarantee you those are probably limited. And once they're gone, they're gone. So I guess we're going to wrap it up, Boone.
All right. Once again, thank you, and we'll see y'all later.
Okay, I'm going to push the button and stop it, okay?
All right.
I'm going to push the button.